Blog Talk Radio.
Well, traders, welcome once again to Live Trading Talk with Oliver Velez. My name is Oliver Velez, of course, and I am your trader for life, or at least I'd like to be. Well, traders, this, I believe, is the seventh episode of Live Trading Talk with Oliver Velez, and I could not be more pleased with the progress that's taken place over the past six episodes. Now, we've had a couple of hiccups and things of that nature, using the platform and learning how to navigate various parts of the show, but you have stood by us. Many of you have expressed deep appreciation for what I'm doing with the show and the time that you obviously know it takes to produce the show and things of that nature. And to be honest with you, I am staggered by your generosity, your comments, your support, the outflowing of just positive energy. And it really deeply motivates me to continue with things like this, to continue to guide my traders and followers, to keep you up to date on current events in the industry. The flame lit, the flame of motivation, the flame of trading. Anyone who has been bitten by this activity we call trading is very special to me. I remember those formative years when I was first bitten by the bug and basically sacrificed everything in my life at the time to focus on this activity. That this bug bit me so hard that my life was overwhelmed and entirely consumed with one predominant thought. One predominant goal. Everything I did was geared toward my hope, my desire of becoming a professional trader. That everything I studied, everything I read, traders, even the friends I made, the places that I went to were all governed by this one single-minded purpose, to one day be able to hold up my hand and say, I'm a professional trader. I used to seek out places where professional traders hung out. I used to go to lounges. I used to walk down the various streets, Water Street and Wall Street and Broad Street, just to pass by some of the known firms, to see how people walked in and out of the buildings. I had my first job out of school was as a staff accountant for a Wall Street-based law firm. Now, think about this. My passion was trading. My first real job was on Wall Street. Is that a coincidence? Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, my office was one wall. How crazy is that? Not just Wall Street, number one, one Wall Street. And I went to office. I went to my office. I went as a very low-level, low-paid accountant in a law firm, right? On Wall Street, but I was excited every day, not because I was excited about being an accountant, and I wasn't. It was because I was close to my dream, and I would pack a lunch every single day because I wanted to save. I saved for my trading account every penny I could. And so I would pack a lunch every single day and take my lunch during my 45-minute lunch break and walk down to Goldman Sachs. And I would sit across the street and watch the traders come in and out of the door, how they walked, what they were talking about, how many people they were with, how did their suit look, what kind of watches were they wearing. I mean, traders, I was obsessed. I used my field of accounting to get close. I used my field of accounting. I studied accounting because accounting was taught as the language of business. That the activity of accounting gave one the ability to rip a company apart, to lift the curtain, if you will, and go behind the scenes. Accounting gave one the ability to go so deep inside of a company's processes that it would almost be as intimate as if you built the company brick by brick. It's every flow, inward and outward. You would know it. The origin of everything that came to birth in that company, you would know its origin. The path of its money. And so even the selection of accounting was driven, geared, shaped, and formulated by my one single purpose in life, which was to be a professional trader. If there was a person bitten by this bug called trading harder than me, I want to meet them. I want to shake that person's hand. I am telling you, I rarely come across a person who was bitten like I was bitten. That I lost every single friend I had. Well, I didn't have a great many anyway, but I lost them all. While my friends at 17 years old and 18 years old wanted to go to the next party, I wanted to rip apart the next company to find the next trade. They didn't get it. And during the dark years, I lost practically every single family member. I sacrificed a lot to do this. And for most of that time, it didn't really feel like a sacrifice. So while there were dark years, oh, absolutely. But most of the time, it didn't feel like I lost anything. That's how hard I was gripped. That's how hard this bug bit me. There was nothing that was going to stand in my way of becoming this and doing this. To this very day, people don't get Oliver Velez. People who know me from back in the day, the companies that have written books about what I've done and accomplished in this industry. Publishers have sent writers to sit in my trading office and to watch me for 2 or 3 months and to come back with a written book. These people are still in touch with me to this very day, and they don't get, Oliver, why is it that you do this? We don't get it. You're an anomaly, dude. It's like, we watch how people talk to you. And like, why do you even deal with that? Like, do they even know who you are or what you've done in the industry? Like, why do you do that? Like, why do you have a radio show and just talk to people about this? Why? Why do you teach, Oliver? I just love it. I love it. I love this. It is not work for me. I love when I run up into various people that I see, in whom I see myself. It tingles my back, the back of my neck. It makes me smile. I know what this can do. I watched the markets change my family's life. I mean, when I was a kid, and I have no time to go into that story at this point, But I watched the market change my family's life as an eight-year-old boy. And while I didn't totally understand the enormity of what my dad's gold run did for my family, I just knew our life changed almost overnight in the gold rush of the late 70s into the early 80s and into the mid 70s, I should say. And that is what started this whole journey of mine, beginning to understand that it was market related, that I went from public schools to some of the best private schools in the entire country, if not the entire world, that our environment changed. And I was too young to understand it at 7 and 8, but I began to understand it at 12 and 13. And my parents had a dream for me. Their dream was their talented son. They found out that their only child, had this enormous talent for playing the piano. Yes, I was a concert pianist at the age of 4. I started playing piano at 3. I had, I guess, everyone told me I had this special talent. It just came easy to me. There were 8 keys or 8 octaves. Like, it's not rocket science. It came easy to me. So at the age of 4, I'm considered a little 4 or 5-year-old concert pianist. I traveled the entire country playing with a group of children who were supposedly special pianists. I played Carnegie Hall. I played all the famous networks throughout this. My family was up in arms. My mom and dad, I was going to be the next great pianist in the world. But 2 things happened to me. 12, 13 years old, I began to understand the power of knowing what makes the world go around, the market. Money, but not money directly, the market, supply and demand. When I began to understand how the market itself had an impact on my family, and why I sat down for hours each day with some of the best piano teachers in the United States. How did that happen? How did I go from going to public school to some of the best private schools in the United States? How did that happen? When I began to understand that, the market began to grip me. And piano playing became less important to me. The market became more important to me. And oh my goodness, when I got 14 and 15 and discovered girls, it was over. It was a wrap for piano. The market and girls, forget it. Done. Piano dead. I stopped. At 16, the extent of my piano playing, 16 into 17, I'd say 16 years old, I played for money to fund my trading account. Yes, I had gigs where I played piano in country clubs and for various venues where they needed piano playing in the background. A ceremony where they needed pianists to play between bringing up award winners. I played for money to fund my trading account, but that was the extent of it. So I say all of this to just express to all of those people who are sort of in touch with me, not intimately, but they watch my post on the various social networks. Maybe some of them know a little bit about my history, what I've done, and so forth, and the books I've written, and the books written about my trading back in the 90s. And maybe they know a little bit about that, but they don't understand why I do this, why I get on a mic, why I have free events to just explain a tactic or a technique. And yes, I mean, I have to not make it extraordinarily costly to do so. That's just smart business. But I do it because it is a labor of love. I do it because, to me, I am the most alive when I'm connected with this activity. And if you followed my work for even a small degree of time, you know that this activity is spiritual to me. This is far more than buying something for a dollar and selling it for two. I can sell crack cocaine like that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if that is your passion, just, all right, I buy something for a dollar and sell it for two. There's a zillion things you can buy something for. Listen, let me give you one of them. All right. There's this craze going on, the hoverboard craze, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. You see it in a lot of videos now. You see it on TV back and forth. You see it on the internet a lot. You see it on commercials, hoverboarding. Now, I was in the mall the other day, and I saw these things being sold in a kiosk in the mall right by me for like $1,500. Are you kidding me? So I decided to check Alibaba. All right, Alibaba.com. These things are selling for $200, $150 on Alibaba. I mean, you want to buy something for a dollar and sell it for two? Go and buy like 50 of these things from China through Alibaba, get them delivered, and sell, undercut everyone. Sell them for $800. I mean, listen, there are a zillion things you can do if all your interest is to buy something for a dollar and sell it for $2. That is not it. This is far grander than that. Because as I've mentioned to you a zillion times, you cannot expect to have even a small degree of success at this. Not even a small iota of mastery until you first have some degree of mastery over yourself. It is amazing that the precepts that are demanded to be successful, the same precepts that call for being a successful trader, are required to be a successful human being or a successful father or a successful employer or a good friend. And that this is an activity, as many of you have heard me say countless times, it is about keeping promises to yourself, keeping your own word, being disciplined enough to do what you set out to do, to be unshakable, to have a resolve that is so strong that life and even the market almost yields to it. I looked at this activity as making me a better individual. So, this is why I do this. It is why I continue to do this. It is challenging and different every single day. Yes, there are many things that are similar, but it's challenging in similar ways every day, but it always gives you something new to work on, and I love that. Otherwise, I would have gotten bored with it a long time ago, like playing the piano. But listen, I digress. February 26th is going to be a very special day for the market as far as I'm concerned, traders. Recently, the New York Stock Exchange, a division of ICE, I-C-E, announced something that created quite a ruckus in the trading community. They announced that as of February 26th of 2016, they would no longer be honoring protective stop orders. That not only were stop orders going to be dead and never accepted again, they also added the good till cancel order to that dinosaur-like list. And not really knowing how to interpret this, this has started to create somewhat of a mini scare amongst the retail trading sect. And I've heard so many different things. The moment the news was announced to me, I was bombarded by emails asking the question, Oliver, what does this actually mean? That I rely on protective stops. I'm panicking now, Oliver. Please tell me what is the alternative today, because I can't stay chained to a computer monitor. What's going to protect me? I heard things like, this is just another blow to the small investor. Another move just to take the rights away from the retail trader again and to shift the focus and the balance of power and advantage back to the institutional world. That this is not fair to take the ability for me to protect myself away from me is not fair. Oliver, give me a reason why you don't seem to be so upset about this move. Talk to me. So it was so, I don't know, these things came with such force that I decided to make it the immediate subject of one of our shows. The New York Stock Exchange will not be protecting or so-called protecting your orders. I, for one, say thank goodness. I, for one, say finally, good riddance. It should have happened 15 years ago. And if not that long, at least 10 years ago. I say 15 years ago, this should have gone by the wayside. Longer. That the stop order is an antiquated dinosaur that has no place in today's technologically driven world. In fact, I say the specialist, I don't want hitmen after me or anything like that. I say the specialist is a dinosaur and he should be next. That not only the tools of the specialist, like the stop order and the good till cancel order and his so-called book, I say not only his tools should be gone, he should be gone. I don't know if you remember. Do you remember watching CNBC back in 2000, back in 1999? And they would have the CNBC anchors in there, you know, Maria Bartiromo in a cute little, you know, skirt suit with her hair nicely done. Big giant eyes, beautiful eyes. On the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, fat, overweight specialist and runners bumping up into her. Do you remember that? Not even saying excuse me, giving her a little jab just because she was a woman on the floor back in the early days. Well, the early days to many of you. Do you remember that? And it was loud. She would have to hold up her hand to her ear because she couldn't hear the studio through her earpiece. So she would have to press the earpiece deeper into her ear and she would have to almost shout. Yes, John, we're down here. And yes, there's a lot of activity going on in the. You remember that? As she held her earpiece. Have you seen those shots today on the floor? No one is getting bumped. No one is passing by. There's basically no more paper on the floor. It's neat. People are relaxed back there talking about their barbecue coming up or whatever, their next vacation. It's a dying breed, and it should be. It should have died a long time ago. It's antiquated. So we're going to talk about that today. All right? We're going to talk about that. Many do not understand, first of all, that the NASDAQ was one of the first exchanges to come into existence that was technologically driven and not the open outcry system. You see, we had the open outcry system. Remember the movie Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd and and Eddie Murphy. Remember the outcry? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Orange juice. Buy, 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 buy. That's the outcry system. All right? That is antiquated. That's been with us from the beginning of our markets. The NASDAQ came into existence and says, we're not going to have an outcry system. And so the tide began to turn right there. The move toward the outcry system, which is heavily reliant on the individuals and their personal relationships on the floor. There was a scene in The Trading Place where Eddie Murphy is, they're really just guzzling it up and they're winning. They're on the floor and Eddie Murphy is sort of writing on a slip of paper and he's saying, don't worry, I've got you. And he points to, with a big giant smile, points to another guy who's dying, fighting everyone on the floor beneath him. I want it, please, please, please help me get out of this. Don't worry, I got you. Personal relationships and giving the order to the guy that's your brother-in-law, and that stuff is gone by the wayside. Now, it's technology. And it should be that way. And the NASDAQ kicked off this move by saying, we're going to form an electronic exchange. And that, in 1972, I think I have my year correct, began the move toward markets leaving the outcry system, leaving the need for a person, leaving the need for liquidity to be provided by a specific individual, eliminating the need for a person to other side of your trade, eliminating the need for someone to so-called protect you, so-called protect you. And we're going to delve into all of these things. I want you to thoroughly understand why not only should this have been dead a long time ago, it was, you were operating at a disadvantage with it, that it was a tool in many cases to take your lunch. So I say good riddance. This is a move I've lobbied for back in the mid-1990s. This is not a disadvantage to traders, but a much awaited godsend. It is one more sign that this antiquated system is going the way of the dinosaur. And it should have a long time ago. Now, in order for you to understand what I'm about to lay out for you, it's necessary for us to go into the role of the specialist. And I do see that I have a few calls, and I will take those calls, but I want to take them after I deliver the vast majority of the punch here. Many people do not understand what the role of the specialist was. I want you to imagine a world where it is a world where your gentlemen wore top hats, top coats, and big giant top hats, the black ones, you know, the black tall ones. They wore top coats with tails every single day walking down the street regularly. They wore pocket watches in their vests. They had the little mustaches that curl up at the end. They didn't wear glasses. Very few people at this time wore glasses. They wore eyepieces. It was not necessary to look at numbers through both eyes. You looked at numbers through one eye. And so these gentlemen with these curly mustaches and these big giant top hats, which were necessary because they conveniently held all of your slips, all of the paper, the commercial paper that you were trading back and forth. They put them in the top of their top. They put them in their top hat and put it on top of their head and walked down the street. And each one of these gentlemen had walking canes, not because they needed help walking, but because it was cool. You were a gentleman if you had a walking cane. You were a gentleman if your tails of your coat almost reached the bottom of the heels of your shoes. The taller your top hat, the taller your silly looking hat, the more you were worth, the more paper you had to hold. Wow, he has a really tall hat. He must be doing really well. My hat's not that big. You know, they pulled out their pocket watches, even when they didn't even really need to know the time, just to look cool. You know? So I want to go back to that time when, if you had, were wealthy enough to own a few thousand shares of a company called General Electric, and you had a need to sell your couple of thousand shares of General Electric, who was going to buy them from you? Like, the participants during this day, traders, were so few and far between that could even purchase that kind of position. Your average individual made like $6 a month. Who was going to buy your 2,000 shares of General Electric or Western Union or IBM later? U.S. Steel. There was no real, true liquid market. And in that time, in order to have some semblance of liquidity, the market needed to introduce an individual called a specialist. This was an agent that would, just like a real estate agent who represents you, this agent would represent you and say, listen, I will help you find a buyer for your 2,000 shares of U.S. Steel or General Electric. Now, I'm going to take a fee. Just like the real estate agent takes a fee for finding you a buyer as a sell. You want to sell your home? I'll find you a buyer. I'm going to take a fee. But see, the specialist says, I'm going to take a fee from you, the seller, and anyone who wants to buy, I'm going to take a fee from the buyer as well. So this specialist came into existence to find you the other side. That was the central role of the specialist, to act as an agent, as an individual that stood between the buyer and the seller, to find the other side when the other side was not there. Like, you want to sell, but there's no buyer. I'll find one for you. Just give me a little taste. And so what he would do is he would mark down the price for the seller and mark up the price for the buyer and take the difference. And so it became necessary for specialists to have and grow their network of buyers and sellers, to grow their relationships of moneyed individuals, moneyed organizations. So they began to grow their network, just like a real estate agent does. A real estate agent has clients that are kind of the fixer-upper guys, and you say, well, listen, if you come across a home that you think that's really good for me, that I can flip, that I can fix it up, put $50,000 or $60,000 in and sell it higher, you let me know. I'm a buyer. So a real estate agent wants a lot of those buyers. Oh, I know who I can get. I can get this house bought by this person. He likes prices in this range. He likes homes that are not perfect, so he can fix them up. This is perfect. I'm going to get him to be a buyer. So just like that, the specialist would get his network of buyers and sellers together. So he would always, some guy would come to him and say, listen, man, I got like 4,000 shares of Western Union. I got to get rid of this. And so in the back of his mind, he knows exactly, I know John is definitely good for 2,500 of this. And you know what? I'll take the other 2,500. You see, the specialist began to actually become part of the player too. So first it was like, I'm just going to be an agent. I'm not going to take any risk. And I'm going to just match buyers and sellers. When a guy wants to come in and buy IBM, he's like, you know what? Rick has 32,000 shares of IBM. I bet I can get him to get off a couple of 2,500 shares for the right price. All right, okay, I'll do it, but you got to give me this. Okay, done. Boom, match. But then the specialist began to take part in the transactions, especially the ones that were guaranteed. So he said, I don't just want the fee. I want the almost guaranteed move up because I know this. So my client, who's the CEO of, who's one of the vice presidents of U.S. Steel, wants to buy 5,000 shares of General Electric. And I asked him, why do you want 5,000 shares of General Electric? And he told me. So now I want General Electric too. So he says, okay, I'll find you 5,000 shares. You got to give me this. And so the specialist began to say, okay, I know someone with a lot of General Electric, him to give up 2,500 shares for a decent price above the market. All right. I'll mark up the price for the buyer for 2,500 and I will the 2,500 or I will take 5,000 from my guy. And so the point I'm trying to explain here is the specialist began to take part of the positions to not only get the fee or the commission, but to play the play as well. And so my question to you today, knowing this, who the heck needs a person to find someone to buy 500 shares of McDonald's? Do you need to pay someone to find you someone who's willing to buy your 800 shares of IBM? Wait a minute. There's no one around, but I'm going to find them for you. Heck no. Then what the heck do we need to pay this guy for? Finding anybody. Why do we need to pay him a little bit? Why does the buyer need to pay him a little bit and the seller need to pay him a little? The market is so liquid today. There are so many players today that you can sell IBM with the stroke of a key, with the click of a mouse. Shoot, before you hit the sell button, your 800 shares of IBM are gone. You're like, oh, well, damn, that was quick. I didn't even really get – I saw it disappear before the button was pressed. It's that quick today. We don't need this dude. We don't need this guy between us. Okay, wait a minute. Okay, John, meet Rick. Rick, meet John. Boom. Okay, both of you pay me. What? Today? No. Computers match today. I don't have to be introduced. I don't need to know the guy's name. I don't need your friend's network. I don't need your special interest network. I don't need your moneyed men. The computer will match. The computer will match my order with somebody else out there. I don't even need to know who he is or where he's from or what's his reason for buying or selling like it was in the old days. I mean, these guys would get to sit down and have a lunch together and then make the transaction. I'm glad I got a chance to know you. So, yeah, I'll sell you 2,500 shares. We don't need to do that today. That's nonsense. That role is obsolete. Another role of the specialist was to begin to become the liquidity provider itself. So the fiduciary responsibility of a specialist is to take the other side of the trade when there is no other side. So, for instance, in a crash type scenario, markets are declining. Nobody wants to buy, or very few. That's what is creating a crash, that there is an exorbitant amount of sellers, but there are not enough buyers to balance the selling. So prices fall. prices are seeking the next pocket of buyers. And if those are easily run over by the sellers, there might not be another pocket for another 100 points down. Boom, market falls another 100 points. There's a few buyers that are going to step up to the plate because they think they're buying cheap. And if they get blown through easily, maybe even the buyers under them will step aside. I'm not stepping in front of this train right now. And that's what causes a collapse. So in the absence of buyers in a market downdraft, the specialist is supposed to step up with his own account and his own money and actually be the buyer. Now, that's the fiduciary responsibility of a specialist, to keep an orderly market. So that even in a runaway bull market, the specialist is supposed to be the seller when the selling side is not balanced. So for instance, let me give you the idea of an imbalanced market. Let's say there's 10,000 shares to buy at a certain price, but only 8,000 shares to sell at a certain price. The specialist is supposed to, just like the first scenario I explained to you, where the specialist wanted to start to participate, the specialist is supposed to fill in the remaining 2,000 shares from his own pocket, from his own account, and make the market balanced. So whenever there's an imbalance, the specialist is supposed to make it balanced from his own capital. So to a certain extent, if the market is balanced, the specialist doesn't really have a true function. It is now when the market is imbalanced that the specialist is supposed to fill in and to create balance. Now, this definition of the specialist role is what has the vast majority of people who really do not know what really happens behind the scenes. They feel unsafe without the specialist. But where's the balance going to come from? It means that during crashes, when there's a great amount of sellers and not enough buyers, we're no longer going to have the specialist providing the balance on the buy side to stabilize the downdraft. And it is this definition that makes them feel unsafe theoretically. But people don't understand that the fiduciary responsibility is to create balance at a price and then create balance at a much lower price. And the amount of balance now is so much more different. The point I'm trying to make here is that in today's market environments, computers can find the balance. Computers can even provide the balance. Computerized specialists, computerized books. It's cheaper, it's more reliable, it's without human error. Not that we can't have technical glitches, of course, that's just one of the costs of going down that route. But I will tell you this, that I believe in free-flowing markets. I don't believe that markets should be artificially retarded by an individual. I don't believe that an untold advantage should be given to an individual because he is willing to provide balance in exchange for the risk that a specialist takes to be the other side when the other side is a little weak, to be the contrarian. All right. In exchange for that, the specialist is able to read everyone's cards. The specialist is able to know where your orders are in the market. The specialist knows there's a stop order for 1 million shares. 5 cents above the current market, and the odds of us getting through that are slim, so the market's likely going to be dropped. That's a license to steal. In fact, in order to place a stop order, the specialist has to know, because the specialist has to put it in his book. his electronic book. Imagine having a poker game where one player is allowed to walk around the table and see everyone's cards, and he's a player too. Like, it's not like he's a referee and sees everyone's cards. It's not like he's the TV audience that sees all the poker players' cards. No, he's one of the players that can see all everyone else's cards. How is that fair? Have you seen any ads in the Wall Street Journal for the need for more specialists? I mean, have you ever seen an ad, New York Stock Exchange specialists want? We're in need of more New York Stock Exchange specialists. Have you ever seen an ad for that? Have you ever seen, has anyone come to your college when you're in college to recruit you to be a specialist? Have you even ever heard of what that is until you got into trading? Why do you think that is? These jobs don't become available. They're so coveted. The specialist is such was historically the highest point on the food chain as far as traders are concerned. Why? Of course, when you see everyone else's cards, how are you not the highest point on the totem pole? How is that not a license to steal? Historically, the only way to become a specialist was to be born the son of a specialist. It's passed down from generation to generation. It's crazy. That's how certain the wealth would come, the money would flow, how almost guaranteed the success was. And naturally so. Everything has to come through me, and I know where everyone's prices are. I know where support is. I know where resistance is. I know where the stock is likely to stop because of this big, giant order that I had to come through me to place. I don't know that. You don't know that. And I don't want anyone playing our game to know that. That's unfair. That is unfair. Oh, but Oliver, the specialist, saves us during market crashes. Well, then if that's the case, why are they still here? Did the specialist save us from the crash of 1987? No. Did the specialist save us from the many collapses that happened in during the Asian Tiger collapse in 97 and the Rupal collapse in 98? Maybe I got them reversed, I can't remember. Did the specialist save us from the collapse in 2000-2001? Did the specialist save us from almost going to the brink of financial disaster during the downdraft of 2007 into 2008? Did the specialist, if the specialist creates balance, how do we have powerful uptrend? How do we have a powerful uptrend for the last 7 years? How do we have all-time new highs? It's just, if the specialist created balance, you wouldn't have movement. There's no balance. There's just that license to take. That license to know your order, and you don't know his. Forget stop orders. Another thing traders have not understood, you have never had stop orders on the NASDAQ, but yet you still woke up every morning, hit your alarm clock, had your breakfast, went to work. Your life wasn't dramatically affected by never having stops on the NASDAQ. In fact, you probably didn't even know you didn't have stops on the NASDAQ. You didn't have stops on your Microsoft position or your Apple position or your Google position or your Netflix position or your Tesla position or your GoPro position or your Yahoo position or your Facebook position, your QCOM position. You never had stops on the NASDAQ. Did you survive? You didn't even know you never had stops. But wait a minute, Oliver, I'm allowed to play stops. Well, that's not the stops we're talking about. You see, you're going to be able to place a stop on your computer, on the servers of your firm. But that order won't go to a person that knows it, who is in charge of the stock. That's what's unfair. You don't want that. You want your stop. You want to know where your stop is, and that's it. So when the price hits, your computer, your server sells it, not this guy who's going to let it run a little bit, then fill you. It really filled differently, but he's going to say it filled worse. Clip you every time because he knows where the price is. So don't think your protection is being removed. You're just going to have computerized stops, not human stops. That's what the New York Stock Exchange is saying. We no longer will have the stops executed by our specialists. But will you be able to tell your computer when this price hits, automatically go into sell at market mode? Yes. That's what it has always been on the NASDAQ. Forever. Never had stops. How could you have stops? There was no specialist in the NASDAQ market. The NASDAQ is a bunch of computers. All right? So don't buy into this. And I see these article writers, you know, they may write like they know, but they don't know squat. As a matter of fact, most of them are disallowed from even being a market player. Do you know that General Electric, who was the owner of CNBC, I mean, back in the early 2000s, I think maybe even before the 2000s, I forget how long it's been, but they forbade their financial news reporters from holding a single stock. You can't have a single investment. You can't have a single trade on. You cannot play the market. Dude, they don't know. I don't. It would be better for you to take the other side. Talk about taking the other side. It would be better for you to take the other side of almost every article that's written. It's crazy. You would do better. As a matter of fact, somebody should do that. Somebody should run a service like that. I bet you make money. This service is dedicated to putting out alerts that are the exact opposite of every single published article. You'd probably beat the market every year, which 75% of all institutional firms can't do every single year. Trust me, no. You know, they're guys that after they write the article, they throw their backpack on and get on the subway and go to their little enclave in Brooklyn somewhere. Come on, dude. They might even have a skateboard in the back. backpack. They don't know, man. Professionals don't pay a lot of attention to that crap. That's not written for professionals. Do you understand that before the news is the news, according to the general public, that the guy who wrote the news had to actually receive the news from someone? That someone knew the news long before he gave up the information. That individual, before they wrote the news, has to get approval from his boss that this is newsworthy. And then something else might be more important to put out there to the public first and say, put this out on Wednesday, not today, Monday. And when it comes out on Wednesday, you think that's news right at that moment. Do you know that just like you run your family, you don't want your entire family to know a certain event the second it happens? Your mother, you know, is a worrier, and something happened to your teenage son in school. The second it happens, do you call your mother? You know your mother's going to become worried. She's 8 states away. No, you let that pass a little bit. You may not ever let her know so she doesn't worry. Or if she does, you'll let her know when it's so far in the past, appropriate now, she'll be okay. I mean, you run your life like that. There are certain things you just don't let people know. And that's the way companies run their lives. There are certain things you just don't allow to become news. And then there are certain things that we want to become news. So what gets out there the vast majority of the time is what is wanted to be news. And what is real news doesn't. Under criminal prosecution, some companies force you to sign confidentiality statements and agreements. You can be put in jail, even if it served the public, but you violated your contract. You're going to jail. We don't buy into that nonsense. Immediately, I think the other way. Now, it may not be the other way, but the first thought is the other way. And so the burden of proof is on it being right. Yes, this is not a democracy as far as I'm concerned when it comes to news. News is guilty unless it overwhelmingly convinces me otherwise. It's guilty right from the, oh, you're news? Okay, you're guilty. You're guilty first until you can overwhelmingly tell me you are the truth. Specialists don't belong in our world today. Function is antiquated. The original purpose of their very existence doesn't exist anymore. They have an unfair advantage. They are paid unfairly, as far as I'm concerned. The advantage they get is no longer commensurate with what they provide. The NASDAQ proved that. Very owners now of the New York Stock Exchange, the very owners of the New York Stock Exchange are completely technical, completely electronic, archipelago, ARCA New York Stock Exchange, a complete electronic exchange. It didn't become New York Stock Exchange / ARCA. Oh no, ARCA / New York Stock Exchange. ICE, electronic exchange, owns the New York Stock Exchange. The dinosaur is being preserved because it is such a, what's the word I'm looking for? Why is this escaping me at the moment? It's just a venerable, one of the U.S.'s most venerable financial firms or items, or it's just, you just don't let that go away. But it's gone. The floor of the New York Stock Exchange is one-fourth of what it was in 1995. One-fourth. That might be even an outdated number. It went from having five rooms to like one room. This is not a sign we're going backwards. This is a sign of progress. Delayed progress, actually. Overdue progress, actually. Crazy. Area code 510, you are on the line. Hello, are you still there? Are you still there with me? Are you there with me? I'm not sure. I hope I can hear you. No, I guess not. Let's see if we can get the next caller on the line. It's been very patient. Greg Mason,
hello.
Hi. You're speaking to Oliver. How are you?
I'm good. This is the second time I listened to the show. I really enjoyed it last week.
Thank you very much.
And I was curious. I was amazed at what you were saying about how what a low price institutional investors trade at. And on top of that, just recently, over the couple of days, I've been thinking about do you know of any way that there is to chart institutional ownership in a company? I don't believe there's anything like that, but what I'd like to see would be something that, just like you have charting software, if you could flip through a company and look at a chart of the institutional ownership, I think that would be a great tool, but I don't think there's anything like that available.
Well, actually, that's not true, Greg. There were many services that I used to subscribe to back in the day. And for some reason, the names are escaping me at the moment, but there were a variety of services that were in book or written form that provided the mix of institutional ownership, even the mix with insider ownership. One such company was called Value Line, but there were several other companies, one of which was put out by William O'Neill's company. He's the owner and founder of an Investors Daily. He had actually a service that you could purchase. You got two or three books with a chart and all kinds of numbers like that, institutional sponsorship, they would call it, and insider ownership or what have you. Those numbers do exist. But I will tell you that obviously it's probably somewhere online right now. And
yeah.
I will say this, that it's always dated. And see, that's one of the issues. So whenever you're looking at a number like that, it's typically 6 to 8 months late and sometimes up to a year. Now, that was the case back then, in all honesty, because I don't look at those numbers very, very frequently now. I don't know if that standard has changed. But we all understood, Greg, at the time when we used to look at those numbers, that we were looking at a picture or a snapshot of the company 6 to 8 months in the past. But I do want to say one other thing for you, that while that can have some interest, it can have some value, I do want you to understand this, that, first of all, I believe most people should deal with the blue, which means to me is your real quality. The firms that I consider to be, if as a metaphor, you want to deal in the neighborhood of a 40-45 year old community that have very intelligent children, a great school system, and everyone is upper middle class. So if we take that analogy, not super, super, super wealthy, but still in their growth phase, still experiencing success, still moving life in the prime of their earning years, 42, 45, not 22, all right, 42, not 82, 42. So if we take that metaphor and apply it to the market, who are our 42-year-olds moving life? You know, Facebook's that they're kind of young. They're the 30-year-olds, the late 20s, 30-year-olds. They're a new breed. But then you have the you know, in a sense, it's the Apples, the 40 to 50-year-olds. They're still moving things. The Googles, they've been around for a while, but they're not your General Electrics back from the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not your Dow Chemical. I mean, there might be moments for that, but you want the younger, more vibrant crowd. Now, when you deal with that blue-blooded category there, you know, and not too old, like early 1900s, but not really young and almost unknown and brash and trying to make a name for themselves either, you want that middle part? You don't really need that number, Greg, because that's all going to have, all of those are going to have very solid institutional ownership. Now, if you're looking for a certain level of ownership, like, okay, I want to find a company where, you know, almost, you know, 80% of the ownership is institutional or what have you, I don't know what value that really, really has, because 80% of all market play is still institutionally driven. And if you're dealing with the blue bloods, you're guaranteed that you have solid institutional sponsorship.
Okay.
Now, if I were dealing with the younger companies just on the cusp of the 25, 28-year-olds that are showing some promise that might become those vibrant 42-year-olds later, I would be looking for small, not non-existent, but small institutional ownership that could become big institutional ownership as the interest in the institutional crowd picks up. I don't want a young player who's almost all institutional, because as that, those are your sellers. They're already positioned.
That's what I was looking for.
Right. They're already positioned in those sellers. I will tell you what stat is far more valuable than that. And you want to, if this is the game you play, you want to really have your finger on the pulse of short versus longs in the stock. Your short interest is a very valuable number at certain points. So more important to me than institutional ownership, because I deal with stocks that just have that and it's solid. I want to know if the shorts get really, really overly heavy in their positions. And it can, contrary to popular belief, it's not always bullish. A lot of people look at it as just bullish. They look at, if a lot of shorts are short, then that's future buyers, which creates demand for the stock, which propels the price higher. But the short community is far more astute than the buy community. And you don't automatically go against a big short interest. They could be right, and they often are right in the short to medium term. But what I like is when I see a stock that's already taken the hit and the short interest is still big. Now it's a possibility for a quick turnaround. But I hope that's been helpful for you, Greg.
Yes, it has. That's exactly what I was looking for. It was the institutional ownerships among small caps. So,
great, fantastic. Well, I'm glad you like the show. Many more to come. I hope to improve along the way, and please stick around. So, traders, I hope I've done justice to this topic. I sort of feel like I was touching upon a variety of things, but the point I wanted to drive home to many of the traders who were concerned with the going away or the passing away of the traditional protective stop on the New York Stock Exchange and all listed stocks for that matter, I just wanted to assuage your concerns, to abate any nervousness you have about this. This, on average, is a good thing. Yes, we can search for a few small things where we wish we would have them in certain rare instances, but they're so few and far between that it's not worth giving an institution, called the specialist, the advantage that we have historically given this institution called the specialist. We live in a technologically driven world, and one which actually completely rejuvenates itself or changes every 8 months of the year. So 8 months prior to today, our technological world was entirely different. We have a new technological world every 8 months. That is a fairly rapid turnover. And while all of this progress, new and improved every 8 months, new and improved every 8 months, the specialist has remained the same. The specialist system has remained the same. It has not improved or inched forward one iota. Antiquated. It's a dinosaur. We don't need it. We don't need a person in between us. We don't need a person in our business. We don't need to pay this person. The era of the middleman is gone. I don't need a middleman. I'll go directly to the source. I'll hit a button that can take me directly to the source. You'll hit a button that will take you directly to the source. I don't need a person to help me find you. If I'm a buyer and you're a seller, we can do business ourselves. We don't need a person managing us or refereeing us and taking a fee from both of us to do it. This is unnecessary layers of just bureaucracy built and designed to take. These guys take risk only once every 5 years. More in a major collapse. And then they don't even do that correctly. You know? So I've never bought into it. As a matter of fact, let me reveal to those of you who have no idea about this, is that I don't trade listed stocks because of the specialists. Ask my traders, what stock do I trade? I trade Apple. And when I don't trade Apple, what stocks do I trade? I'm not talking about wealth positions. I'm not talking about taking a stake in Home Depot at 28, which we did. You know, I will play a listed company over a period of time, but to trade for my living, to earn money every day, I just never did it. I stayed with NASDAQ. I felt it was fairer, despite the reputation that NASDAQ market makers have for ripping off the public. I felt that not that they were honest. They were not the bunch of honest Abes or anything like that. But, you know, you've got to pick the least of your two devils. To me, NASDAQ was fair. To me, I felt more in control. I understood it better. It was cleaner, black and white, more black and white to me. But some people who understood what the market, what the specialist had to do during certain circumstances, when he had to step up, when he could release and step back. Some of those traders that got to really understand the specialist movements began to actually manipulate and exploit the specialist. And there are a group of traders that really got very good at that, especially back in the 2000s and the late 1990s. The specialist started to become clipped by very astute traders that began to study and understand that game, and then to flip it and use the specialist game against him. The specialist has to go up now, has to raise his bid. By law, the specialist has to raise his bid. That's valuable information that you can use. You know, so that began to happen. The advantages that they used to have also dwindled. You know, you don't give up something like this if you're not battered a little bit or hurt. You know what? We're closing this store down. We're not going to pump any more money into it. We're closing it down. It's done. I mean, that's really what's happening here, right? Same way a retail firm says, listen, we tried to make it work in this neighborhood. It just doesn't work. Not our type of client. You know, stop putting money into it. Close it down. All right? Specialists, it's not working for them. They're not going to let something go that's working for them. It's not working anymore. No, we can't. It's not. We just can't make the same that we used to make on it. Let's just give it up. And it's electronic world now anyway. You know? And that's where we have it. So I say good riddance. I also say don't worry. Nothing much is really going to change on your end. You'll still be able to place an alert or a server-based stop, which you have always been doing on NASDAQ anyway. And this server-based stop will become a market order at the alerted point. All right? Now, let me touch upon a few things before I let you go. I've got a few more minutes here. I once again want to really express just my deepest appreciation for your support. It really means a great deal to me. Your comments, your encouragement. It takes a lot of work it's not work to me. But it does take a lot of time, there's a lot of energy, a lot of effort into doing things like this. There's no real monetary benefit for it. I just love it. I love connecting with traders. I love talking to them. I'm alive when it comes to this market. All right? I want all of you who are interested, everyone who's been bitten by the bug, follow me on Facebook, follow me on Instagram, follow me on Twitter. Very simple, OLVelez007. I have recently begun filming, live streaming my actual trading in the morning. And I could not be more excited about that development as well on Periscope. So now Periscope obviously is a platform that's not really built for the PC. It's built for your smartphone. You download the app called Periscope and you just add me or search me, OLVelez007, and you will be alerted when I come on live, which I've been doing every day since I've logged on to an established Periscope. And we've had these little mini live lessons. Traders have watched me enter trades, exit trades while I'm explaining. It's been a little cumbersome at times for me to hold the camera and trade, which I usually trade with hands. And that's another thing. Some people have watched me trade over the last few days on Periscope and say, Oliver, man, why don't you trade with a mouse? Professionals don't trade with a mouse, guys. My traders will kill you. They will beat you every single time if you're a mouse trader. You can actually be smarter than them, and they will beat you if you're a mouse trader. It is impossible for a mouse trader to have the speed, the agility that a keyboard trader has. So no, we don't trade with the mouse. We trade with hotkeys. So it's been a little bit difficult for me to hold my smartphone. I have a Galaxy Note 5, and at the right distance so that it's clear while I'm placing my trades with one hand, which I usually do with two hands. Because when you have a hotkey system, guys, what you typically do is you place a dual hotkey. This eliminates or mitigates problems and technical glitches. Not technical glitches, but mistakes, keystroke mistakes, which almost every professional trader has keystroke mistakes. But you minimize your keystroke mistakes if you make your hotkeys two-stroke hotkeys. So it requires a left-hand action and a right-hand action simultaneously. And it minimizes the mistakes. Because if it's one-handed, you can easily hit that. The mouse can hit it. Your elbow can hit that key. You can drop your pen. It can hit that key. You can mistakenly hit the wrong key. Oh, my God, I just bought 2,000 shares. What? You know, so two hands. And so it's hard kind of to hold the camera and the trade and place the trades. And traders have watched me, like, give back $500, $600 in a trade because I'm talking to them on Periscope, trading with one hand when I should be trading with two hands, explaining when I should be just focused on what I'm doing. But it's been a lot of fun. And it's been great to bring you into what I do every day, to bring you into my home, to bring you into my trade, to bring you into my thought processes. Some traders have actually even decided that they're going to take the trades that I'm doing. And many of them get back to me and say, Oliver, man, I made this on your trade today on Periscope. Thank you. That's so awesome. It's so cool. Technology today is why the specialist doesn't exist anymore, or his role is being diminished and diminished and diminished. It is why stop orders are not necessary to be executed by a human individual anymore. Technology, machines, they're taking over. Now, you can look at this as a sad thing, or you can get on board and just use it. You know, every generation has basically said that it's sad. Something's been sad every generation. My parents said things were sad. My grandparents said things were sad. This generation says things, oh, man, it's sad. But life is going to go on. So you either embrace these changes and find ways to use them in what you do, exploit them for an opportunity for yourself, or you just are just another one of those people who say things are sad and life passes you by. You know, not pleased with your support for this show and all of the things that I've recently decided to do on the social networks. I truly appreciate it. I hope that you are gaining a deeper insight through all of these activities into some of the things that I do, some of the things that I'm about, some of the things that my traders and I do. But more importantly, I hope that you're getting that this is allowing you to feel me a little bit better. There are certain things I'm just simply not able to communicate or do. There's a certain level of insight that I'm unable to share with you in certain other mediums, and mediums like this allow me to do it a little better and to allow us to touch each other in a way that is very effective. And I'm hoping that's being accomplished here. So once again, for our 7th broadcast, thank you so very much for attending. I produce every Wednesday that I can at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Once again, thank you for joining Live Trading Talk with Oliver Velez. My name is Oliver Velez, of course, and I am your trader for life.